Is your garbage bin overflowing with mounds of garbage following the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, especially if you were hosting friends and family at your house? We will talk about how much garbage we produce and how we might reduce it, and how our society takes care of the trash we discard with a trash anthropologist this hour. That's right, a trash anthropologist. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, December 2nd. I hope you had a very nice Thanksgiving. I hope that you will join us with your questions about garbage accumulation and collection and how we might reduce the amount of trash we throw out. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will find out 6 trashy exercises that might help change our relationship to what we discard this hour as well. Let me welcome our guest. She is Robin Nagel. She is the author of Picking Up on the Streets and Behind the Trucks with the Sanitation Workers of New York City. She is the anthropologist in residence for New York's Department of Sanitation and a professor of anthropology at New York University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So happy Thanksgiving to you. Did you have, I suppose you probably didn't. You're probably good at not throwing away a lot of trash.
Well, I was a guest at someone else's home, so the trash throwing out chore did not fall to me this weekend.
Me too. That was the same here. But, you know, today, Monday, is our trash pickup day in my neighborhood, and I typically don't really give my garbage a whole lot of thought, and I did today because we are talking with you. Let's start with what is a garbage anthropologist?
Well, it's a title that I've been given because people consider it unusual for an anthropologist to look at sanitation workers as a kind of culture unto itself. But really, I'm just a plain old anthropologist who happens to have a subject that people think is a little bit odd. I'm bringing, you know, sort of the classic tools of anthropological inquiry to a research project about people who are absolutely essential to our well-being every day. And when I say our well-being, I mean everybody in the United States. We need sanitation workers every day.
So we should thank a sanitation worker over these Thanksgiving holidays.
That's a good idea, absolutely.
So, but you have devoted your career to this matter, to studying this matter. What made you care so deeply about garbage?
Well, I talk in the book about, it's what I call a once upon a time story. I was about 10 years old hiking in the Adirondacks, which is a wilderness area in the northeastern part of the U.S., and it's beautiful. It looks like there have never been human beings there. But we arrived at our campsite, and I discovered that campers before us had been too lazy to take out with them what they brought in and instead had left a dump. And I was flabbergasted. I was absolutely amazed and horrified. And the question in the moment was, who did they think was going to clean up after them? And that question stayed with me from when I was a kid. And when I moved to New York City, I'm looking around this huge metropolis and I'm saying, oh, those guys in the white trucks, they clean up after me. So who are they? And what is that work? And what does it take to do it well? And what's it like? So that was the beginning of the question.
And you became a sanitation worker to find out what it was like?
I did. I was on the job for a few months. It was a great privilege and a very interesting education. It's a simple job in when you look at it from the outside, but when you take it as your own responsibility, it's marvelously complex.
Yeah, well, talk a little bit about that. How is it marvelously complex?
It's the basics of it. You show up on time and you roll out at the appointed hour and you have a route you're supposed to, that you're responsible for. But once you're on the road, anything can happen that makes it difficult to get the job done. Before you get on the road, there are just a thicket of regulations and policies you have to make sure to follow, which start with your dress code. There's a personal appearance code that New York City sanitation workers have to follow. If your job involves the mechanical broom, that I spent some time learning how to operate the broom, and you're surrounded by three banks of dashboards with dials and gauges and ways to measure how the machine is working and what's the pressure of one broom versus the other and the water and the I talk about it as if you're flying a very slow, very low to ground airplane, and it takes quite a while to become really good at a broom. I was not on the job long enough to become expert, but it gave me even more respect for the kinds of knowledge that you have to master if you're going to be if you're going to do that job well. And then in New York City, sanitation workers are responsible for plowing snow in the winter. So that's a whole other area of knowledge and of remembering that once you put a plow on the front of a garbage truck, the physics of that object are different. The turning radius and the weight and how you're going to be able to move through traffic, it's all changed. So if you're not used to it and a newcomer on the job, their first snow is a big, that's a big scary thing. That was a whole other, I didn't know a garbage truck, a 19-ton truck with chains on it, can get stuck. But in fact, it can, and I did a few times.
Well, I thank snowplow drivers every day of the winter in Wisconsin, and I believe that we have a streets department that the workers do both as well. I'm not absolutely positive, but I think at least in Madison, that's the same thing. I do want to talk more about the sanitation worker, but I also want to talk about what, you know, the job of what they're doing. Do we have any stats on how much garbage we create in this country?
Sure. The interesting part about that question is that the stats contradict each other. According to the federal EPA, we generate about 4.6 pounds of garbage per person per day. But different analysts look at the numbers a little more closely, they would say, a little more rigorously, and their estimate is closer to 7 pounds per person per day. But that gets into questions of how do you define garbage and how do we include industrial waste that's used to manufacture a product that then we buy in a store. So is it waste that we put in our own garbage can and take out to the curb, or is it all the waste that stands behind the waste we see in our homes? That's one of the challenges of coming up with that number.
And does that does not include or does include the things we recycle?
It depends. It depends on who you're talking to. Generally, no, it does not include what we recycle. That's a separate number, although, again, different sources compile those figures in different ways. It does not include sewage. That's a whole other category of waste that has its own set of laws and whatnot.
And so 7 pounds, perhaps, per person of garbage. I'm bad at math. How much does that add up to for the entire country?
A whole lot.
Yes. And are we producing more and more garbage every year, or are we getting better at maybe not discarding everything?
We are producing more every year, and we're also recycling more every year. So the numbers, both numbers are going up, but they also wobble with the economy. So when we had some difficulties in 2008, 9, 10, rates of garbage dropped. We were making less garbage. We were also recycling less because there was just less stuff. And Joy, to go back to your question about the total number of the total amount of garbage, according to some folks at Columbia University here in New York and BioCycle magazine, which is a really wonderful trade journal about recycling and solid waste, the United States generated 389.5 million tons of trash as of 2008, which is, they do these analyses every 2 years. So this year we're going to learn the numbers that they crunched from 2012, which will reflect 2010. But now I'm getting a little wonky on you.
No, that's 395 million tons. That's
389.5. And of that, just so you know, 69% was landfilled, 24% was recycled or composted, and 7% was burned in a waste-to-energy facility.
We are talking about trash and our what we discard and who cleans up after us. As we talk with Robin Nagel, she is the author of Picking Up, On the Streets and Behind the Trucks with the Sanitation Workers of New York City. And we'll welcome your questions. Maybe you have some questions or ideas on recycling or reusing or reducing trash. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 20 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, the 2nd of December. We are talking with Robin Nagel. She is the author of Picking Up, On the Streets and Behind the Trucks with the Sanitation Workers of New York City. She is the anthropologist in residence for New York's Department of Sanitation and a professor of anthropology at New York University. And we thought after the weekend's holiday festivities, we would talk about the mounds of trash left behind. Our guest is an anthropologist who knows all about trash and whose mission is to help us think more creatively about garbage. And as we go along, we will also talk about some ways that we might change our relationship with what we discard. And we welcome your questions. What creative ideas do you have to recycle, reuse, or reduce? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Gary on Facebook posts, if you want to see the biggest ratio of trash to treasure, just walk into a post office and look into the garbage can. I am wondering what percentage of the volume of all the mail handled by the post office is immediately tossed away. Well, apparently he sees a lot of junk mail in the garbage cans. Do we have any idea what some of the biggest culprits are in the garbage that we generate, Robin?
There is a surprising quantity of paper still, even though most states do have robust paper recycling programs. There seems to be a gap between the policy, the enforcement, and the practice. Interesting question about the post office. I don't know what their policy is about recycling paper, but in general, there is far more paper still in the trash than most people would expect, given that it's almost 2014, and we've been doing paper recycling pretty well for a long time.
Right, right, yeah. I'm assuming that they recycle it, but who knows? Matthew on Twitter says, I guess we have to incorporate fuel and fertilizer to the lessons of recycle, reduce, and reusing our garbage. Oh, I guess he means we can use our garbage for fuel and fertilizer. Do we do enough of that?
We do quite a lot of using garbage for fuel. For fertilizer, we also do that, although that's a specific kind of waste we need to, like, mostly we need various forms of poop, to use the technical term. But certainly using garbage as fuel, in some places it's called a biofuel, which implies that it's kind of renewable. And there's a controversy there, too, because the other side of the argument is if we make it okay to generate garbage as much as we want because we're going to use it for fuel, there's no motive for creating less garbage, and that maybe that's the wrong direction to go. However, until we solve the problem of how much we make, burning it for fuel can be a smart idea. Another controversy is that you can call it a waste-to-energy facility, but it's still an incinerator, and there's a whole lot of bad press about incinerators and the kinds of pollutants they put into the air. And it's true that there's no completely inert way of getting rid of garbage, but in terms of air quality issues, some studies suggest that incineration waste to energy is actually less damaging to the environment than landfilling, where you have all kinds of off-gassing happening in ways that are not controlled. So, as ever with garbage, there are few simple answers.
So what is it that... No, there's not a simple answer to this either, but what is it that we're going to see in the typical or the average landfill? What's filling up all that space?
It depends a lot on how the laws are written for a particular state, what they allow and what they don't allow. Generally, the federal regulations distinguish between municipal solid waste, which is what you and I put in our garbage can and then it goes in the back of a collection truck from our homes. Then there's hazardous waste, which is that's a broad category that includes many scary toxins and poisons. A lot of that is from industrial sources, although there's a subcategory called hazardous household. That's a separate thing. Then there's construction and demolition debris, or C&D, and that's falls under a broad umbrella of non-municipal solid waste. So it depends on what the landfill is permitted for. That governs what it can accept. All of those categories and many more are very tightly controlled by legislation that is at the municipal, the county, the state, and the federal levels. That doesn't mean there are no problems, but unlike, say, 50 or 60 years ago when garbage was not really tightly regulated, there's just this web of laws around what you can and cannot discard, where, and when.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get some calls in before our newscast. Kevin in Lancaster is with us. Hello, Kevin.
Yes, good morning, Joy and guest. The three R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle, are, of course, well known to everybody. And yet, I've heard a couple times already this morning that it's been verbalized as recycle, reduced, and reuse. And I really think that we need to focus and be mindful of the fact that recycling is not the best way to deal with our garbage. And we need to first reduce, then reuse, and as a third priority to recycle, because recycling requires energy to be done, and the others don't. And one easy way to do that, there's of course a number of ways, but one thing that I've found, and I think that is probably overlooked by our consumers, is when you go to the grocery store, you know, unfortunately, it's usually cheaper to buy the larger container, but it's also more efficient in terms of less packaging per unit of commodity consumed to have the bigger item. Sometimes when you go to the grocery store, it's actually cheaper, though, to buy a smaller one just because of the crazy way that we market stuff. And so sometimes I have to make the difficult decision to pay a little bit more for the larger one. But usually that's not the case. So usually it's an easy decision to get the bigger one.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry, Kevin. We're almost at news time. Did you have another point?
Well, just that with all this, the individual packaging, like individual potato chip, smaller containers and smaller coffee, single-serving coffee things. If we can avoid that, we'll certainly reduce our amount of packaging. Thanks.
Thanks. And I will say reduce, reuse, and recycle in the proper order from now on. Robin, what about that?
Kevin makes an excellent point, and the recycling choice should be the last after reducing and reusing. I'm grateful to him for kind of recalibrating our focus, because that's exactly right.
And the buying a larger item rather than a smaller item is maybe a simple rule of thumb, and then reusing that?
It could be. It depends entirely on the actual commodity that we're talking about. And it can create challenges. Like people who live in some parts of big cities like Milwaukee or Chicago, that they might not have that option. So like Costco and BJ's, those places, you have to have a membership. So you can buy in bulk, but you have to have enough money to actually join first. So it's a great idea. It's not always easy. Then you get things like buying cooperatives or food co-ops. That can make a big difference, but that requires sort of citizen organization, like people deciding, yeah, let's pull together and make that happen. And, of course, Wisconsin has a long and honorable tradition of that kind of citizen activism, of people saying, here's a problem, we need to solve it, let's figure out how.
And I have just a minute before news. I really have to start using my own, fill my own Keurig cup rather than buying the throwaway Keurig coffee cups, don't I?
That would be good. And you could also carry your own thermos or durable coffee mug instead of getting disposables when you're out and about. I started doing that myself in the last few months, finally. And it's a very interesting, changes the whole relationship with the object and with coffee, and you forgot it. So are you going to have a cup of coffee, even though it has to be in a cup, a disposable cup, or are you going to forego the coffee? As you know, foregoing caffeine is sometimes a really tough choice.
Impossible choice here, but I know what you're saying. We are talking about trash, and we welcome your thoughts and questions on how we can reduce, reuse, and recycle our trash. We are talking with Robin Nagel. She is the author of Picking Up. I'm Joy Cardine. We'll check news and then we'll be back. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about what we throw away and who picks up after us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Monday, December 2nd. We are talking with Robin Nagel. She is the author of Picking Up, On the Streets and Behind the Trucks with the Sanitation Workers of New York City. She is the anthropologist in residence for New York's Department of Sanitation and a professor of anthropology at New York University. And we are welcoming your questions for her, and we are welcoming your ideas to reduce, reuse, and recycle. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We also want to talk about 6 trashy exercises to help change our relationship to what we discard. And Robin, let's talk about those exercises that you have. What's your number one trashy exercise? Oops, I have to push, and now we can hear you. Go ahead.
There are a few of them. One that sounds easy but is a little bit harder in practice. It's what we mentioned a minute ago. Choose an object that normally you use in disposable form and replace it with a durable, and then remember it. In other words, if you usually get a coffee in a throwaway cup, take a thermos or another kind of travel mug that you're going to then keep and remember to wash and bring with you again, or a cloth shopping bag instead of a plastic bag, or those kinds of things that we just use once and let go of. Replace that with a durable counterpart, and it not only helps cut down waste, but it also, it's such an interesting challenge, especially before you make it a habit, because you have to remember the object, and you have to decide when you forget it, what do you do then, and how do you care for it when it gets a rip or when it gets broken. So that's one practice, and it's both practical, and it's also kind of, I like to suggest that people do things that help them see their own habits in greater relief, and sort of it highlights our ways, our habitual ways of thinking. Like the flip side of that is keep the disposable, but use it as long as you can until it wears out. Again, going back to the coffee shop, let's say you get a muffin in the morning and they put it in a paper bag. Well, hold on to that paper bag and bring it back the next day and the day after that and see how long it lasts. It's sort of a cousin practice. So those are two that I have my students do.
And a disposable object like a plastic water bottle, reuse that as often? I was told to be careful about that.
Be careful, why?
Because of plastic leaching into my water or something.
Well, plastic is leaching into your water whether or not you reuse it. Plastic is its own evil, which I encourage you, if you have the interest, to devote an entire show just to plastic, because it's a thick and fascinating issue. But every time you use a plastic water bottle, unless it is specifically made as BPA-free, and even that isn't regulated yet quite as much as maybe it could be. But, yeah, you're getting the plastic off castings in that water, whether you use the bottle over and over again or whether you just buy a fresh bottle every time.
Right. We have done shows on plastic, too. That's right. And you also recommend that we sort of redo our own anthropology here and figure out what sort of trash management system that we have in our communities?
We take it for granted everywhere we live. We assume that it's going to be dealt with, and either it's a municipal service or it's a private service, and then we have to have a contract with a private carter. But besides those basic sort of, is it run by the city or is it run by a private company, we generally don't pay too much attention to how the work is organized, and if there is a recycling program, is it what's called single stream, where everything goes into one bin and then it gets sorted at a recycling facility, or do we, the individual householders, have to sort it at the curb? And how many people are working on the truck, and how many women are there, and what is it? What do you have to do to get the job, and what union represents it, and what are the hazards of the job? People are generally unaware that being a sanitation worker is many times more dangerous than being, say, a police officer or a firefighter. Sanitation work is always ranked among the 10 most dangerous jobs in the nation by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, partly because you're in and out of traffic all the time, and a lot of people get hurt or killed because they get run over. And the other source of danger is what goes into a compaction truck, a sort of classic collection truck model. That can sometimes come flying back out if the pressures of the machinery hit that bag just wrong. And then if you're in the way of what's flying out of the back of the truck, you may get very, very hurt. So those are some of the things that are generally not well known. And since it's a system we rely on so completely for our well-being every day, it makes sense that we might bother to learn a little more about it.
Yeah, it was a few years ago that Madison has, I'm sure, a different system than many of the other communities in Wisconsin, but in Madison, we switched over from the old-fashioned garbage can that the sanitation worker would manually pick up and throw into the back of the truck to these plastic bins that a mechanical arm from the truck will grab and pick up and toss for instead of the sanitation worker. And I had no idea the amount of injuries that had resulted, like back injuries for sanitation workers doing it the old-fashioned way.
Yes, back injuries were very common. The other thing about the old-fashioned garbage can made of metal, they get dented, they get holes in them, they rust, they get jagged edges. People put the lids on haphazardly and it rains, and then you have garbage soup. In New York, there have been arguments about let's bring those back because we use a lot of plastic bags, big garbage bags on the curb, which, of course, are easy for rats to get at. But cans have their own set of risks and dangers. The mechanical system that you mentioned, that's become increasingly popular all over the country, and it can save both, it can lower injury rates, and it also can lower labor costs, because usually you only need one person in the truck instead of two to get the garbage up using a mechanical system like that. However, there was a case here in New York City where two workers were on one of our, we have not very many mechanical trucks because of the logistics of trash collection here, but this crew was working on a mechanical truck, and there was a blockage at the top. So one worker climbed up to clear the blockage, and her partner did not realize she was up there, and he activated the arm that holds the trash into the truck, and it caught her in the back of the head, and it killed her.
Oh.
So even with the mechanization, these are big, powerful machines, and things can go wrong, and people can get hurt.
Let's take some more calls. Leah in Green Bay is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. We're talking about, you know, consumers' responsibility to taking care of, to reduce garbage consumption. But what about manufacturers? It's Christmas time. I've been doing this for about a year, so I go shopping for my family, And I will cut out of the products out of the packaging and leave the packaging at the store, because you end up with more packaging than you end up with product. I know that it prevents shoplifting, but I don't know any other alternative to keeping the trash. For me generating the trash, I bring my own bags and such. I'm doing my part, but I don't know what manufacturers could do to be doing their part. Mm-hmm. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
That's a fantastic point. And yes, you're exactly right. We as consumers are faced with choices where there's a ton of packaging, or if you are out and about and you need water or food and it's inside of plastic. The manufacturer's responsibility here is huge, and that's not where our focus has been quite so much yet nationwide. It's, in my opinion, the next big push has to be not just looking at municipal waste and our own household garbage, but going upstream, as they say, and looking at how manufacturers are creating products, what kinds of rosins and plastics are they using that then have these, after we use these plastics, they exist in the environment for no one knows how long, potentially hundreds of thousands of years. And the packaging issue, that's huge. You have a small object that's inside of this sort of box that you have to wrestle to get at. I agree with you completely. My I don't want to say hesitation, but when I think about that side of the problem, it's going to involve political activism and people asking questions exactly like yours up at not just at the level of the street, not just at the level of the town and the city, but almost writing to the manufacturers and saying, listen, you got to fix this. But then what's the pressure? There has to be bigger collective pressure. We American citizens, organize curbside recycling into a very effective nationwide effort that 40 years ago didn't exist. I think it's time to move to a broader horizon for things like recycling and back it up and look at the source of the stuff that we buy and say, couldn't this be made more sustainably? Couldn't this be packaged more sensibly? Couldn't we have less waste on the way to the store where the choices are in front of us?
Thanks, Leah, for the call. Judy in Ripon is with us now. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a question for the guest. Kind of a springboard off of what you just said about things being in the dump site for hundreds of thousands of years. When we have a cup of coffee that we didn't finish, we toss it in the plastic. We have a bottle of soda that we don't finish. We leave half of it in the plastic and throw it in the trash. That trash then gets tied up very tightly in a plastic bag and thrown into the dump site. And other liquids, like if you're peeling potatoes and you throw your garbage into a plastic bag that gets sealed up very tightly with diapers too. All these things, it might seem like it's negligible for one individual to do that, but when multiple hundreds of millions of people are throwing things into liquids, into bags that are tied very tightly, and then those liquids don't re-enter the water cycle. Has anybody looked at anything like that?
The liquid you refer to, Judy, when it's in, when it's sort of collected in a dump site, it becomes this stuff called leachates, which is garbage juice, basically.
Mm.
And, yeah, those bags are tied tightly, but remember, they're also being tumbled around with lots of other bags, and there are other objects inside the bags, and they very often break. So then that liquid starts to seep out and percolate. And in the old days, before the laws were so strict, all that stuff then would go down to the water table and threaten aquifers and sources of drinking water. Landfill laws now are very strict about linings and ways in which there's an impermeable barrier so that those liquids don't reach water supplies. And a contemporary landfill is also going to have what's called a leachate treatment system, where it's a series of pipes that will pull the liquid out and then treat it like at the equivalent of like a sewage treatment plant. So once the water is released, it's clean again. In fact, it's drinkable. But the juice, that juicy stuff, that's really gross, and it's a big problem because it's not just, say, when you have a tea bag or leftover coffee. If you add something like nail polish remover in tiny quantities in the home, that doesn't seem so dangerous, but it's actually the same substance as some forms of hazardous waste And then you mix that in, and it begins to, as you say, collectively become poisonous. So a contemporary state-of-the-art landfill addresses all of that. When it's sitting by the side of the road or it's in a dump instead of a landfill, that's a problem.
We are talking with Robin Nagel. She is an anthropologist. She's a professor of anthropology at New York University. She is the anthropologist in residence for New York's Department of Sanitation, and she is the author of the book Picking Up, On the Streets and Behind the Trucks with the Sanitation Workers of New York City. And we are talking about all of the garbage that we accumulate and who picks up after us. And we're welcoming your questions, your experiences, your thoughts on this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about garbage for the rest of this hour and how much garbage we produce and how we might reduce it and how our society takes care of the trash we discard. And we're welcoming your questions. We have so many calls. Let's go to Terry in Monona. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Yeah, some years ago there was a program, I don't know if it's a regional program, that certain paper products were shredded, and then it was pressed into bales, like hay bales, and it was used on farms, you know, for bedding. Then after it's been used on the farm, it's put out onto the field and spread out in the field and obviously plowed under. I wonder whether that program is still in existence or if it was found not to be too effective.
Do you know, Robin?
I don't know. I love that idea. I wonder if there were problems with the chemicals in the paper. It often uses a lot of bleach, and if the ink also has sometimes chemical traces that I don't know this, but I'm wondering if over time it proved harmful to the animals or was something that they didn't want to plow into the soil. But if those problems, if those were not problems or if those problems could be solved, what a fantastic use of paper. And I have to say, as someone who works in a couple of administrative responsibilities as well, probably the best use of some of that paper ever.
Let's thank you very much, Terry, for the call. Let's go to Dan in Drummond, who's been waiting. Hi, Dan. I understand you used to work at a landfill.
I used to take care of a landfill, and I want to give your guest a little chuckle. I used to, for many years, a couple of years that I took care of the place, I used to tell people, they asked me what I did, and I said I used to be down in the dumps. Then I decided to come up with a little bit better description of what I did, and I told people, well, what I did, I was a garbologist that studied garbology.
And what did you learn when you're doing that, Dan?
Oh, the stuff that people would throw out. That I had one lady come out one winter day and give me a little General Electric cassette player. And I checked, and she was gone, and the only thing that was wrong with it, she had the batteries in wrong.
Aw.
Oh, no.
I had a 16-album record collection of Elvis Presley come out 6 months before he died.
So people were throwing away things that were really valuable things that didn't need to be thrown away, Robin.
So, Dan, did you keep those things?
Dan's not going to say. Dan, did you keep those things?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Well, I sold off most of the Elvis albums and that. But the question I wanted to ask, when she was doing the garbage detail, you could tell from the garbage who was rich, who was middle class, and who was poor, couldn't you?
Oh, very much so. And in fact, workers who have been on the same route for a little bit of time can tell you things like individual families, whose fortunes are improving and who is struggling and who just had a child or got a divorce or started drinking again or got sober. You can read very great detail into the lives of people whose garbage you pick up. Now, I'll say, just because this makes people nervous, in New York City, and I'm sure in the rest of the country, sanitation workers don't care that much. They're not looking to learn about you, but they notice a whole lot when it's passing under their eyes on the way to the truck in those plastic bags that break.
Sure, and I'm sure they've seen a lot of different things. But unfortunately,
absolutely,
I don't think we have time to go into some of the more amusing ones. Let me go to Marcus in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I live in an apartment complex, and we place our garbage and recyclables in three different dumpsters. And in the garbage dumpster, I always see, and a lot of us see, TVs, you know, batteries from automobiles and all sorts of things that shouldn't be in there. And I just wondered what happens after they pick that up. Does this big truck go sort it out, or does it go right into the landfill? It's, you know, kind of unnerving.
Yeah, does somebody take care of stuff that shouldn't be in those bins?
It depends entirely on what is the system for that particular city. Generally, if it goes in the back of the truck, that's it. It's in the back of the truck, and then it goes to whatever is the final disposal. If it goes in the back of a recycling truck, it might be sorted. But things like televisions and other appliances like that often count as electronic waste or e-waste. And the recycling protocols in the U.S. for e-waste are sort of still in their infancy. There's some really good regional programs, but nationwide, we don't. It's kind of scattershot where that is done well.
Well, because we have just a minute to go, Robin, and boy, this has gone fast. Maybe you can give us one takeaway about garbage, maybe something we can do today to make us think more about what we throw away.
I'm going to suggest two quick things. One is, just as an experiment, tell someone you love that you have decided, or your child or someone younger than you has decided that they're going to be a sanitation worker, and just watch the reaction, because it's very telling how people react to that as an ambition for a career. And then the other thing is, keep an eye out for the people who pick up after you, and when I say you, I mean all of us, and especially in the holiday season, tell them thanks. But even not in the holiday season, tell them thanks. They don't get that very much, and we mm-hmm. certainly need them, and it's, I think, entirely appropriate to
yep.
tell them we're grateful.
I will do, and thank you very much for being with us. Robin Nagel is the author of the book Picking Up. Thanks to Marika Saval and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.